Chapter 64. Before sunset on the memorable day on which King Charles I was executed, the House of Commons passed an act declaring it treason in anyone to proclaim the Prince of Wales, or anybody else, King of England. Soon afterwards, it declared that the House of Lords was useless and dangerous, and ought to be abolished, and directed that the late king's statue should be taken down from the Royal Exchange in the city and other public places. Having laid hold of some famous royalists who had escaped from prison, and having beheaded the Duke of Hamilton, Lord Holland, and Lord Capel, in Palace Yard, all of whom died very courageously, they then appointed a council of state to govern the country. It consisted of 41 members, of whom 5 were peers. Bradshaw was made president. The House of Commons also readmitted members who had opposed the king's death, and made up its numbers to about 150. But it still had an army of more than 40,000 men to deal with, and a very hard task it was to manage them. Before the king's execution, the army had appointed some of its officers to remonstrate between them and the Parliament, and now the common soldiers began to take that office upon themselves. The regiments under orders for Ireland mutinied. One troop of horse in the city of London seized their own flag, and refused to obey orders. For this, the ringleader was shot, which did not mend the matter, for both his comrades and the people made a public funeral for him, and accompanied the body to the grave with sound of trumpets, and with a gloomy procession of persons carrying bundles of rosemary steeped in blood. Oliver was the only man to deal with such difficulties as these, and he soon cut them short by bursting at midnight into the town of Burford, near Salisbury, where the mutineers were sheltered, taking 400 of them prisoners, and shooting a number of them by sentence of court-martial. The soldiers soon found, as all men did, that Oliver was not a man to be trifled with, and there was an end of the mutiny. The Scottish Parliament did not know Oliver yet, so, on hearing of the king's execution, it proclaimed the Prince of Wales King Charles II, on condition of his respecting the Solemn League and Covenant. Charles was abroad at that time, and so was Montrose, from whose help he had hopes enough to keep him holding on and off with commissioners from Scotland, just as his father might have done. These hopes were soon at an end, for Montrose, having raised a few hundred exiles in Germany and landed with them in Scotland, found that the people there, instead of joining him, deserted the country at his approach. He was soon taken prisoner and carried to Edinburgh. There he was received with every possible insult, and carried to prison in a cart, his officers going two and two before him. He was sentenced by the Parliament to be hanged on a gallows 30 feet high, to have his head set on a spike in Edinburgh, and his limbs distributed in other places, according to the old barbarous manner. He said he had always acted under the royal orders, and only wished he had limbs enough to be distributed through Christendom, that it might be the more widely known how loyal he had been. He went to the scaffold in a bright and brilliant dress, and made a bold end at 38 years of age. The breath was scarcely out of his body when Charles abandoned his memory, and denied that he had ever given him orders to rise in his behalf. Oh, the family failing was strong in that Charles then. Oliver had been appointed by the Parliament to command the army in Ireland, where he took a terrible vengeance for the sanguinary rebellion, and made tremendous havoc, particularly in the siege of Drogheda, where no quarter was given, and where he found at least 1,000 of the inhabitants shut up together in the great church, every one of whom was killed by his soldiers, usually known as Oliver's Ironsides. There were numbers of friars and priests among them, and Oliver gruffly wrote home in his dispatch that these were knocked on the head like the rest. But Charles, having got over to Scotland, where the men of the Solemn League and Covenant led him a prodigiously dull life, and made them very weary with long sermons and grim Sundays. The Parliament called the redoubtable Oliver home to knock the Scottish men on the head for setting up that prince. Oliver left his son-in-law, Ireton, as general in Ireland in his stead. He died there afterwards, and he imitated the example of his father-in-law with such goodwill, that he brought the country to subjection, and laid it at the feet of the Parliament. In the end, they passed an act for the settlement of Ireland, generally pardoning all the common people, but exempting from disgrace such of the wealthier sort as had been concerned in the rebellion, or in any killing of Protestants, or who refused to lay down their arms. Great numbers of Irish were got out of the country, to serve under Catholic powers abroad, and a quantity of land was declared to have been forfeited by past offences, and was given to people who had lent money to the Parliament early in the war. These were sweeping measures. But, if Oliver Cromwell had had his own way fully, and had stayed in Ireland, he would have done more yet. However, as I have said, the Parliament wanted Oliver for Scotland. So, home Oliver came, and was made commander of all the forces of the Commonwealth of England, and in 3 days away he went with 16,000 soldiers, to fight the Scottish men. Now, the Scottish men, being then as you will generally find them now mighty cautious, reflected that the troops they had, were not used to war like the Ironsides, and would be beaten in an open fight. Therefore they said, if we live quiet in our trenches in Edinburgh here, and if all the farmers come into the town and desert the country, the Ironsides will be driven out by iron hunger, and be forced to go away. Apostrophe This was, no doubt, the wisest plan. But as the Scottish clergy would interfere with what they knew nothing about, and would perpetually preach long sermons exhorting the soldiers to come out and fight, the soldiers got it in their heads that they absolutely must come out and fight. Accordingly, in an evil hour for themselves, they came out of their safe position. Oliver fell upon them instantly, and killed 3,000, and took 10,000 prisoners. To gratify the Scottish Parliament, and preserve their favor, Charles had signed a declaration they laid before him, reproaching the memory of his father and mother, and representing himself as a most religious prince, to whom the solemn league and covenant was as dear as life. He meant no sort of truth in this, and soon afterwards galloped away on horseback, to join some tiresome Highland friends, who were always flourishing dirks and broadswords. He was overtaken and induced to return, but this attempt, which was called the start, apostrophe did him, just so much service, that they did not preach quite such long sermons at him afterwards as they had done before. On the 1st of January, 1651, the Scottish people crowned him at Scone. He immediately took the chief command of an army of 20,000 men, and marched to Stirling. His hopes were heightened, I dare say, by the redoubtable Oliver, being ill of an ague, but Oliver scrambled out of bed in no time, and went to work with such energy, that he got behind the Royalist army, and cut it off from all communication with Scotland. There was nothing for it then, but to go on to England. So it went on as far as Worcester, where the mayor and some of the gentry proclaimed King Charles II straightway. His proclamation, however, was of little use to him, for very few royalists appeared. And, on the very same day, two people were publicly beheaded on Tower Hill for espousing his cause. Up came Oliver to Worcester too, at double quick speed, and he and his Ironsides so laid about them in the great battle which was fought there, that they completely beat the Scottish men, and destroyed the Royalist army, though the Scottish men fought so gallantly, that it took 5 hours to do. The escape of Charles after this battle of Worcester did him good service long afterwards, for it induced many of the generous English people to take a romantic interest in him, and to think much better of him than he ever deserved. He fled in the night, with not more than 60 followers, to the house of a Catholic lady in Staffordshire. there, for his greater safety, the whole 60 left him. He cropped his hair, stained his face and hands brown, as if they were sunburned, put on the clothes of a laboring countryman, and went out in the morning with his axe in his hand, accompanied by 4 woodcutters who were brothers, and another man who was their brother-in-law. These good fellows made a bet for him under a tree, as the weather was very bad, and the wife of one of them brought him food to eat, and the old mother of the 4 brothers came and fell down on her knees before him in the wood, and thanked God that her sons were engaged in saving his life. At night, he came out of the forest, and went on to another house which was near the River Severn, with the intention of passing in 2 Wales. But the place swarmed with soldiers, and the bridges were guarded, and all the boats were made fast. So, after lying in a hayloft covered over with hay, for some time, he came out of his place, attended by Colonel Careless, a Catholic gentleman who had met him there, and with whom he lay hid, all next day, up in the shady branches of a fine old oak. It was lucky for the king that it was September time, and that the leaves had not begun to fall, since he and the colonel, perched up in this tree, could catch glimpses of the soldiers riding about below, and could hear the crash in the wood as they went about beating the boughs. After this, he walked and walked until his feet were all blistered. And, having been concealed all one day in a house which was searched by the troopers, while he was there, went with Lord Wilmot, another of his good friends, to a place called Bentley, where one Miss Lane, a Protestant lady, had obtained a pass, to be allowed to ride through the guards, to see a relation of hers near Bristol. Disguised as a servant, he rode in the saddle before this young lady to the house of Sir John Winter, while Lord Wilmot rode there boldly, like a plain country gentleman, with dogs at his heels. It happened that Sir John Winter's butler had been servant in Richmond Palace, and knew Charles the moment he set eyes upon him. But, the butler was faithful, and kept the secret. As no ship could be found to carry him abroad, it was planned that he should go still traveling with Miss Lane as her servant to another house, at Trent near Sherborne in Dorsetshire. And then Miss Lane and her cousin, Mr. Lascelles, who had gone on horseback beside her all the way, went home. I hope Miss Lane was going to marry that cousin, for I am sure she must have been a brave, kind girl. If I had been that cousin, I should certainly have loved Miss Lane. When Charles, lonely for the loss of Miss Lane, was safe at Trent, a ship was hired at Lyme, the master of which engaged to take 2 gentlemen to France. In the evening of the same day, the king now riding as servant before another young lady set off for a public house at a place called Charmouth, where the captain of the vessel was to take him on board. But, the captain's wife, being afraid of her husband getting into trouble, locked him up, and would not let him sail. Then they went away to Bridport, and, coming to the inn there, found the stable yard full of soldiers who were on the lookout for Charles, and who talked about him while they drank. He had such presence of mind, that he led the horses of his party through the yard as any other servant might have done, and said, "Come out of the way, you soldiers. Let us have room to pass here." ... As he went along, he met a half-tipsy ostler, who rubbed his eyes and said to him, "Why, I was formerly servant to Mr. Poeter at Exeter, and surely I have sometimes seen you there, young man?" ... He certainly had, for Charles had lodged there. His ready answer was, "Ah, I did live with him once. But I have no time to talk now. We'll have a pot of beer together when I come back." ... From this dangerous place he returned to Trent, and lay there concealed several days. Then he escaped to Heal, near Salisbury, where, in the house of a widow lady, he was hidden 5 days, until the master of a collier lying off Shoreham in Sussex, undertook to convey a gentleman to France. On the night of the 15th of October, accompanied by 2 colonels and a merchant, the king rode to Brighton, then a little fishing village, to give the captain of the ship a supper before going on board. But so many people knew him that this captain knew him too, and not only he, but the landlord and landlady also. Before he went away, the landlord came behind his chair, kissed his hand, and said he hoped to live to be a lord, and to see his wife a lady, at which Charles laughed. They had a good supper by this time, and plenty of smoking and drinking, at which the king was a first-rate hand. So, the captain assured him that he would stand by him, and he did. It was agreed that the captain should pretend to sail to Deal, and that Charles should address the sailors, and say he was a gentleman in debt who was running away from his creditors, and that he hoped they would join him in persuading the captain to put him ashore in France. As the king acted his part very well indeed, and gave the sailors 20 shillings to drink, they begged the captain to do what such a worthy gentleman asked. He pretended to yield to their entreaties, and the king got safe to Normandy. Ireland being now subdued, and Scotland kept quiet by plenty of forts and soldiers put there by Oliver, the Parliament would have gone on quietly enough, as far as fighting with any foreign enemy went, but for getting into trouble with the Dutch, who in the spring of the year 1651 sent a fleet into the Downs under their Admiral Van Tromp, to call upon the bold English Admiral Blake, who was there with half as many ships as the Dutch, to strike his flag. Blake fired a raging broadside instead, and beat off Van Tromp, who, in the autumn, came back again with 70 ships, and challenged the bold Blake, who still was only half as strong, to fight him. Blake fought him all day, but, finding that the Dutch were too many for him, got quietly off at night. What does Van Tromp upon this, but goes cruising and boasting about the channel, between the North Foreland and the Isle of Wight, with a great Dutch broom tied to his masthead, as a sign that he could and would sweep the English of the sea. Within 3 months, Blake lowered his tone though, and his broom too, for he and two other bold commanders, Dean and Monk, fought him 3 whole days, took 23 of his ships, shivered his broom to pieces, and settled his business. Things were no sooner quiet again than the army began to complain to the Parliament that they were not governing the nation properly, and to hint that they thought they could do it better themselves. Oliver, who had now made up his mind to be the head of the state, or nothing at all, supported them in this, and called a meeting of officers and his own parliamentary friends, at his lodgings in Whitehall, to consider the best way of getting rid of the Parliament. It had now lasted just as many years as the king's unbridled power had lasted, before it came into existence. The end of the deliberation was that Oliver went down to the house in his usual plain black dress, with his usual grey worsted stockings, but with an unusual party of soldiers behind him. These last he left in the lobby, and then went in and sat down. Presently he got up, made the Parliament a speech, told them that the Lord had done with them, stamped his foot and said, "You are no Parliament. Bring them in. Bring them in." Apostrophe at this signal the door flew open, and the soldiers appeared. "This is not honest," apostrophe said Sir Harry Vane, one of the members. "Sir Harry Vane!" apostrophe cried Cromwell. "Oh, Sir Harry Vane! The Lord deliver me from Sir Harry Vane!" Apostrophe then he pointed out members one by one, and said this man was a drunkard, and that man a dissipated fellow, and that man a liar, and so on. Then he caused the speaker to be walked out of his chair, told the guard to clear the house, called the mace upon the table, which is a sign that the house is sitting a fool's bauble, apostrophe, and said, "Here, carry it away." Apostrophe, apostrophe being obeyed in all these orders, he quietly locked the door, put the key in his pocket, walked back to Whitehall again, and told his friends, who were still assembled there, what he had done. They formed a new council of state after this extraordinary proceeding, and got a new parliament together in their own way. which Oliver himself opened in a sort of sermon, and which he said, was the beginning of a perfect heaven upon earth. In this parliament there sat a well-known leather seller, who had taken the singular name of Praise God Barebones, and from whom it was called, for a joke, Barebones Parliament, though its general name was the Little Parliament. As it soon appeared that it was not going to put Oliver in the first place, it turned out to be not at all like the beginning of heaven upon earth, and Oliver said it really was not to be born with. So he cleared off that parliament in much the same way as he had disposed of the other, and then the council of officers decided that he must be made the supreme authority of the kingdom, under the title of the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.